Okay, so welcome to Internet Technology and Security. And this audio and these slides, as always, are copyright Creative Commons, and we welcome all of you listening over the Internet or while you're driving your car and doing study. What's that?
At the same time.
At the same time? Oh, driving your car and studying? Yeah, that's true. Or walking, or sitting on the bus and listening. Oh, so this is just copyright things. Bang. Okay. So the entire purpose of the next few hours of this lecture is so that you will find this particular comic funny. Now, if you already find the comic funny, then you could maybe answer questions or help me. But if you don't yet find the comic funny, you just wait a couple hours, and hopefully in a couple hours, this will be, well, as funny as XKCD comics are. They kind of make you chuckle, but not necessarily laugh. So this is an XKCD comic. I love XKCD because XKCD allows these things to be done Creative Commons, which means as long as I acknowledge them, I can use them. They use them in books and stuff. It's like, this person's awesome to do it. You know, I mean, so here I am promoting XKCD. So you'll go click on their site and you'll make money advertising, and that's cool. It's the way it ought to be. Okay, so we talked last week about the history. And we talked about how these horrible phone companies would dig these trenches between here and Chelsea and dump a copper wire in, and then make money off these copper wires by us making phone calls or transferring data. And we found ways to optimize. We found that if we sort of made little tiny steps in distance, multiple schools, that we could get connectivity a lot cheaper because we didn't have to have like a star pattern where data went to the four corners of the world with direct connections. But then that slowed us down, right? It slowed us down because this data would stop in each one of these computers and maybe wait an hour in each one of the computers. And we also talked about the ARPANET, the research networks that were going on with intense military funding from the 60s on. And basically they were dedicated to a very different notion. They were dedicated to the notion of a packet switch network rather than a message queuing network where, you know, the messages sort of get in line and then they work out their way one at a time. The idea was is to break each message into little tiny chunks, and the chunks would use the wire for like a tenth of a second or 1 second or something like that, and then that would give up the wire so somebody else could use it. So I've been multiplexing. It's a sharing of the wire. Also, we wanted to be able to make it so that if any one place got shut down, the data could find other routes. So multiple routes, dynamic, and if each packet is tiny, you lose a few packets, you can send them again. So the store and forward networking is kind of the way we did it in academia. The research networks, ARPANET, and FRIENDS did it with packet networking. And as Larry Smarr mentioned last week, this was kind of a club. It was a well-funded bunch of people in computer science departments that would go back and forth between, they'd like even work at DARPA for a while in the government, and then they would go back to computer science and they would bring money with them. The money just kind of was in this little club. The beautiful thing was is there was really bright people, and they were funded for nearly 20 years, well-funded for 20 years, which allowed them to repeatedly throw away solutions and start over. Because the goal was to solve this problem and truly solve it. And so the idea is that we break these big messages up into small packets and then we can sort of multiplex them. They still go across the wire one at a time, but because they're smaller fragments, we can have short messages bypass long messages. It also simplified the kind of hardware we needed inside the network. We didn't need disk drives because packets were small. They were like, you know, they're just like postcards and you just sort of store and you forward them and you get them out of there. You don't have to keep them. And so here's my example where I'm sending a 30 character note to Daphne out in California. And I have, hello there, have a nice day. My packet size is limited to 10. And again, that's to allow others to use these wires, not just me. And so, but we have to add stuff to each packet. So just like a postcard, you have to put a from and a to address. And because we want to reassemble these, we got to put a sequence number on them. So I break my message into three packets and I dump it into my mailbox. And now I've got three packets sitting in my mailbox, packet one, packet two, and packet three. So, you know, the mail carrier comes and sticks them in the mail carrier's thing and takes them down to the mail office. And then sort of they get thrown into a truck to Chicago. And then in Chicago, they kind of get separated, right? Packet two falls on the floor for a while, and a packet one gets sent to Minneapolis. So one is going to Minneapolis, and another one, packet three is going to Missouri. Packet one's in Minneapolis. Packet two sits on the floor for a while, and then packet one makes it to Wyoming, and then packet three makes it to Memphis and down to Houston, and then packet two ends up going to New York because they just swept some things up, and then it goes to North Carolina, but this one now makes it to Albuquerque, and this one makes it to California, and then this one goes to Las Vegas. This one's finally made it back to Indianapolis, and now it goes to Omaha, and then this one goes to here, and now this one finally makes it to Tulsa. This is just a snake bit packet. It just can't find its way, and it goes down to here, comes back across the border to Tucson, and then finally makes it there, right? Okay, and so these poor little postcards just get sort of tortured on their way across the country because that's, you know, they're the low postage thing, and so the post office kind of just says, hey, we'll leave them on the ground, we'll do whatever. And so Daphne opens up her mailbox on one day, and out come packet one. So it goes, well, it looks like Chuck's sending me some stuff. And then later out comes packet three. And then much later, poor packet two, who had a really bad trip, shows up. And now she can finally assemble and see what the note I was sending to her was. And so the way we do this with technology is we have sort of high-speed local area networks. This might be Wi-Fi or Ethernet. Let me see if I can find a piece of Ethernet. Usually there's a wire sitting hanging around here somewhere. Oh, come here, Ethernet. Well, maybe not. Well, usually there's wire here. So, local area network. And so this is like Ann Arbor. This is like Stanford University. And in between, we've got these computers. Now, they're specialized computers. They're smaller. They don't have disk drives on them. And then they have, like, outbound connections for each computer. And so your packet somehow finds its way across the Michigan campus. It dumps into kind of what we call a gateway to get it out. And then it sort of wanders across. And another packet might come out, and it'll come out the gateway, and it'll wander a different way. So they can come out of outer order, too. It's really just no different than a bunch of postcards. And those are intermediate postal stops, and they can make mistakes, or things can happen, right? You could have like a post truck end up in a river, and now your little postcard's totally smashed, and you got to figure out later that it failed. So this seems kind of crazy. Why wouldn't we just make a long-distance phone call instead? And the long-distance phone call, unfortunately, is costly, because actually what's happening is under the covers, the phone company's doing something quite similar. So this is all about sort of packet switch networks. So I want to show you a video that I shot last Monday. I might have shown you a little tiny bit of it, but I'm now going to show you all of it. So this is VintSurf. Claimed by all many, pretty much agreed as one of the fathers of packet switching, TCP/IP, and the ARPANET. So we have the moment where the ARPANET sort of ended and the NSFNET began. We saw that. So this is basically a piece that I call a brief history of packets.
Specifically studied by Len Kleinrock at MIT, who was actually looking at message switching, and he did a brilliant dissertation on the use of queuing theory to analyze what networks and queues would look like using this message switching approach. And his analysis, although we've never used the word packet, is equally applicable to packet switching as it is to message switching. So that's one important milestone in around 1961. In 62 or thereabouts, Paul Barron is doing work for the RAND Corporation and is deeply concerned about the ability to preserve command and control in a post-nuclear environment. We were seriously worried that the Russians would actually launch and that we would suffer a nuclear attack and that we had to be able to respond, and we needed command and control for that. So Paul, in 1962, before the existence of integrated circuits or anything else, is saying we really should be digitizing and packetizing voice and then using sort of pole-mounted radios that are able to transmit in all directions to create a highly connected environment so that if holes were knocked out of it by nuclear explosion, you would still, if it's a fabric that's in any way connected, information could get from one end to the other. So he envisioned the notion of a message block, and it was dynamically routed. He used hot potato routing. If you got something, you got rid of it as fast as you could. He chopped up the speech into little 20 millisecond pieces. He didn't talk so much about data as I remember it. And this was supposed to be a highly resilient voice network for command and control. I may have just done him a disservice because later he was very much conscious of the importance of data communication too. So that's around 1962. It gets documented in an 11-volume series called On Distributed Communications, and he can't sell it to anybody. The traditional telcos, AT&T in particular, and people at what was then the Defense Communications System, or Defense Communications Agency, laughed him out of the room and said this was a silly idea, it couldn't possibly work, and so, you know, he should just go away. So he never got anywhere with that, in spite of all the documentation. In 66, Larry Roberts, along with one other guy whose name I'm now remembering, does a point-to-point experiment to test packet switching. It was between the ANSFQ 7 machine at System Development Corporation in Santa Monica and the TX2 machine at MIT, the Lincoln Laboratories, which is what Larry was. They demonstrated on the 2400 bit per second line that you can move packets back and forth. Now, I will pause for just one second and say that there was another major effort called the semi-automated ground environment that started in the 1950s. It was also a network, but it was kind of a star-shaped affair, where data would come from distant early warning radars in Canada and go to the SAGE interpretation center that would be looking to distinguish between Russian bombers coming over the toll and Canadian geese, because you didn't want to launch on the morning that Canadian geese were pooping all over your lawns. That system actually never worked, according to some sources, although my introduction to computing was with the SAGE system in 1958. I have a certain resonance walking into this dark room with a tube-based computer system and a bunch of guys with great big radar displays and a light gun. That was my introduction to what computing was all about. I'm totally mesmerized by it. But SAGE was around as a networking concept. So we have 61 Lincoln Clonard, we have Paul Barron. Then in the 64 or 65 timeframe, a man named Donald W. Davies at the National Physical Laboratory in London also gets the bug, tries to get money from the Science Research Commission in England, and gets only enough to build one node, the one node network. So he builds this packet net, he invents the term packet to describe what these objects are, and it works. He's got a bunch of terminals and other things hanging off of this one network. So in a funny way, he built a local area network, if you like. But it was based on physical wires. So those three guys introduced packet switching. Larry and whoever it was that he worked with demonstrate that it's possible to get two very distinct kinds of computers to talk to each other using the standard way. Then Bob Taylor, who was running the, I'm sorry, I should mention one other person. J.C.R. Lickwire is a psychologist, actually, at MIT, but he's convinced in the early 60s that computing is important to non-numeric processing, that it will allow people to work together and collaborate in ways that they never could before. He comes and starts the Information Processing Techniques Office at ARPA, with this bee in his mind. And who does he encounter? He encounters Douglas Engelbart at SRI International, and the two bond, basically, because Engelbart was all about non-numeric computing and the ability of people to build up the superstructure of communications and documents and interact with each other, hyperlinking, the mouse, the portrait mode display, black and white presentations. I mean, the guy had a World Wide Web in a box at SRI. And Licklider understands that. Licklider sending out notes to his little community of people talking about the intergalactic network in tongue-in-cheek. So he really gets credit for having put this meme in place at ARPA. Then Taylor comes along to pick up the responsibility for running the IPTO from Licklider, and is all hacked off because he's got three terminals in his office at the Pentagon connected to three different machines, and he says, why can't there be one terminal talking to all three? We need a network. And so as he's pursuing this idea with Charlie Hertzfeld, who's the head of ARPA at the time, Charlie hands him $1 million over a 20-minute conversation. And now Taylor's got the problem, who's going to actually do this? Because Taylor's not a technologist either. He's another, you know, kind of psychologist type. So he decides to get Larry Roberts from Lincoln Laboratories, who did that packet thing, and Larry doesn't want to come. So he goes and complains about this to Charlie Hertzfeld. Charlie calls up the guy that runs Lincoln Laboratories and says, you know, we pay for a significant fraction of your research budget every year, and you should tell Larry you should show up. And in fact, I thought that maybe Larry had been forced to do this, you know, by Charlie. I think it was probably a little less awful than that. But Larry was persuaded to come down. Eventually, of course, inherited the operation of the office from Bob Taylor. But in the meantime, is the guy responsible for initiating the internet, or the ARPANET project. So they write an RFC, or an RFQ, request for quotation. A bunch of responses come back, probably on the order of a couple dozen. I don't know personally for sure how many. I know that I wrote one of them with my colleague, Steve Crocker, while we were still at UCLA as graduate students, but we were consulting with a company called Jacobi Systems in Santa Monica. Jacobi Systems wrote one of the responses. Bolt, Baranek, and Newman wrote another response, primarily written by Bob Kahn, who comes to BBN from MIT. So the responses come back and they get evaluated, and four of them end up, and the Jacobi Systems one isn't one of them, or if it was, it didn't get selected. BBN got selected. So Steve Crocker and I kind of hiked back to UCLA as graduate students. And the next thing we know, Len Kleinrock, who's at UCLA and who's written, you know, his original dissertation work on packet switching, has come to UCLA to teach and explore queuing theory, is a close compatriot of Larry Roberts, because they were both in Lincoln Labs together. So he gets the Network Measurement Center piece of the ARPANET project. And Steve Crocker and I and John Postel, all of us from the same high school in Santa Monica, or in San Fernando Valley, end up in Len Kleinrock's operation running the Network Measurement Center. So I was the principal programmer for that. Steve Crocker took the responsibility for managing and leading the network working group that led to the protocols, host-to-host protocols. And John Postel eventually becomes the keeper of the documentation. He's the RFC editor, which Steve Crocker started, Request for Comments. He's the guy that becomes the numbers czar, which is keeping track of address spaces and allocations, and eventually becomes the domain name manager of the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority when the Internet happens. And that hasn't happened yet. So I don't know how far you want to go on this story.
This is absolutely lovely. I like the fact that you're kind of moving quickly through it, right? And because so we're about to make the protocols, right?
We're up to this period of time of the ARPANET program. It brings us up to 1972, and this is an important moment in this whole history because the first demonstration of the ARPANET happens in the Washington Hilton Hotel basement. In October of 72, a whole bunch of people from the interested networking community, packet switching community, attend, not only in the US, but from France and from England and Italy and Germany and elsewhere. That group of about 25 or 30 people convenes, sees the ARPANET in operation, sees applications that were being done, including Doug Engelbart's stuff. And then forms this international network working group, modeled after the working group that Steve Crocker managed to build the ARPANET system. And at this point, I become the chairman of that group because Steve is busy at ARPA doing artificial intelligence. At the end of that year, Bob Kahn leaves Bolt, Baranek, and Newman and goes into ARPA. I leave UCLA, where I've been working with Kleinbach and Crocker and Costell, and I go to Stanford. So Bob is at ARPA, I'm at Stanford, and in the spring of 73, Bob comes out from ARPA, and he says, I have a problem. He says, what's your problem? He says, well, we got this ARPANET. I said, yep. But we also are working on other networking capability to make command and control work for the military. If you're going to be serious about putting computers in command and control, they have to be mobile. They have to be in, you know, armored personnel vehicles and tanks and all these other things. They have to be seaborne, so we can have ship-to-ship and ship-to-shore communication. We need a satellite. And we, so we need mobile radio, we need satellite, in addition to the fixed wire systems that are represented by the ARPANET. We have fixed installations that are not moving around. So we have all these different technologies, and Bob's brilliant idea is not to build one network with all those technologies embedded in it. Instead, he breaks them apart and says, let's build a packet satellite network, which optimizes the use of satellite, takes into account that it's got a half a second round trip time. Let's build a packet radio network, which optimizes a system whose connectivity is changing with time as things move around and you get variable delay and also variable interference. So these were three different packet networks. Then the problem is how you hook them together. You wouldn't have this problem if you put all the technologies into one NAT. But if you put them all into one NAT, it makes it really hard to do control over all these highly variable parameters. So instead, he says, break them into different networks and connect those together. So we designed and built a gateway, which today we call the router. And that concept also introduced a whole bunch of other things, like how do you refer to another network? Each network thinks it's the only network in the universe. This is true of the proprietary networks like SNA and TechNet and so on. And you didn't have a vocabulary to say, take this packet and move it to another computer on another network somewhere else that you might not even be connected to. So we have to invent an internet address space in order to solve that problem. We have to find a way to allow packet losses in this path to be recovered, which is where TCP now becomes a manager of reliability on an end-to-end basis instead of relying on each net to be reliable. The ARPANET was built on the assumption you could build a reliable underlying net. The internet was based on the assumption that no network was necessarily reliable and you had to do end-to-end retransmissions to recover. So during this, this 1973 period, Bob and I get the papers, first paper written and published in IEEE Transactions on Communications, May of 1974. And I think mostly nobody paid too much attention to it. Meanwhile, ARPA is funding us to go make this actually work. And so by 1974, we published a paper, and at Stanford, I am working with my graduate students, some who are at Xerox PARC, some are at Stanford, on detailed specifications of TCP/IP. We published that in December of 1974. And it's the first time the word internet shows up in print anywhere. It was the first papers we talked about internetworking. So internet shows up in a complete spec in December of 74, and it's also got bugs, but we don't know that yet. Until we start implementing it in 1975 with two other organizations. So Bob Kahn says, can't have just one implementation. Bolt Baranek and Newman becomes one of the implementers. University College London and Peter Christine's group in England is the second or third implementation. So we have three implementations of TCP/IP. In fact, by this time it's only TCP. We haven't broken out the IP part. Three implementations are going. We instantly find problems with the design, and we start evolving. So over a period from 1973 to 1978, we go through four iterations of the design and implementation and tests until we have a fairly stable thing. And then we standardize. So 78, we fix everything. It's now by this time the internet protocol has been split off because people like David Reed and Danny Cohen are saying we need to have real-time communications that is not necessarily reliable but which is low latency. So voice communications, radar tracks and all that. You don't care where the missile was 2 seconds ago, you want to know where is it now. So, and in the case of voice, if you lose a packet, you just say that again, I missed something. So we split TCP into TCP and IP, and we create something called User Data Gram Protocol, which is parallel to TCP, and it is the real-time, low-latency version of the reliable TCP. All of those little components, IP, TCP, and UDP, now go into the Internet architecture, starting in 1978, and we start implementing. For the next 5 years, we do everything we can to get TCP/IP implemented on every operating system we can find. It goes on to the IBM machines, it goes on to the digital machines, HP, it goes into the Unix. And we have a Unix version built by Goldbaranek and Newman. We send out to the Berkeley BSD with these guys, and Bill Joy says, I don't like that code. He writes his own, puts it into BSD 4.2, and that's the version of Unix that carries a lot of TCP/IP to the academic world, because at the same sort of time frame, Sun Microsystems comes along and builds these fantastic workstations, and they want to use open source, or at least open protocols, open operating systems. So they adopt Unix, and the TCP/IP comes with it, and they use Ethernet as a way of connecting workstations together, so they are the engine that's driving the academic community, which are all gangbusters for workstations and high-speed mobile networking. So all of this, of course, places huge demands on the ARPANET backbone, which is only running at 50 kilobits a second, and eventually leads to the need for higher speed, and NSF jumps into the fray, seeing how valuable all this is for the academic community, and concludes that it should build a network that runs even faster, and it does so, and it's called NSFNet.
So I could just dismiss you, right? And you can just watch that. The rest of this lecture is kind of redundant. He pretty much said everything, but I will give you some more detail on what he said. So a couple things to take away from what Vint said. First off, this is not just computer people. There were sort of applications people who had these mental use cases that were in powerful positions and positions that held money, right? So psychologists like Engelbart and Licklider, they were in powerful positions to say, I want this. I don't exactly know how you geeks are going to figure this out. I believe if I give you enough money, you will eventually figure it out. So there was this kind of higher level use cases from the beginning. The other thing a question that listening to him talk was answered for me, because I've always wondered if the purpose of the ARPANET was for wartime concerns, or was it sort of for kind of using and connecting people? And the answer is really both, right? I think they talked about, I got three terminals in my office and I want to go down to one. That's just a practical money saving thing. I want to get people to talk to each other. That is, so it's not just for wartime, but at the same time, it's hanging out in the Department of Defense. And so there's always people coming in with sort of wartime and command and control applications. So the answer is it wasn't built to survive nuclear war per se, but at the same time, that logic led to sort of this philosophy that you'll see in a bit about unreliable and all these things that say, look, we got to do this. So both of those things are sort of, you know, good sort of pure motivation to make the world a better place for humans and end users, and then we got to be able to keep our war machine running during war, was really both part of it. So one of the things, as Vint was talking, he at least talked about four or five complete rewrites of the concept of how to do this as new problems, new technologies, and everything came. And it resulted in this four-layer model, and it didn't start out a four-layer model. He even talked about how the TCP layer and the IP layer used to be together, and then they got split apart. And this layering of models is a critical engineering approach for building technology. You got to sort of, if you have a problem that's this big, it might be impossible to solve, but if you can find a good way to cleanly break it into four little subproblems, you can solve the subproblems separately. And so this network, this four-layer network model that is TCP/IP that we'll be talking about for the rest of this lecture, it wasn't something that somebody sat back in 1960 and drew on a board. It came because of the need as engineering problems came up and had to be solved. So when we draw this picture, it's really simply breaking a problem down into four more manageable subproblems and then connecting those together. There are other models. There's this OSI model that has seven layers, open system interconnection model, which is a little more of an academic model that never was particularly successful. And so Another thing that Vint mentioned was RFCs, requests for comments. All of these things were engineered very much in an open intellectual property kind of space, right? They didn't want to create secret government things behind closed doors, behind security lock. They published like crazy the ideas that they had because they wanted as many eyeballs on it as possible. Here, Department of Defense people and Department of Defense funded people are doing these things having to do with the ultimate command and control of the U.S. military, and yet you could go download the specifications for the protocol on the internet and implement it yourself. Well, you didn't have an internet back then, but if you could get your hands on it, you could see the specifications. So IETF is the Internet Engineering Task Force. It is the group. He mentioned John Postel, who was kind of like the keeper of these RFCs originally. John Postel, unfortunately, is one of the people that's no longer with us. The word engineering is an important word here. And if you recall from last week, one of the IETF meetings in April 1993 was where Tim Berners-Lee was almost crying about the lack of the adoption. So this is just a meeting that happens like four times a year for the last 20 or so or 30 or so years. And they do lots of things. What we're going to talk about today is more the low-level protocols of the actual stuff. They also worked on HTTP, and we saw some of the RFCs for that. The RFC is sort of like a encoding a kind of a cultural meme into the name of the document itself. The idea was is that this group was not supposed to be make its decisions by voting. There was not supposed to be any lobbying. There was not supposed to be any vote packing. The only way that your idea would win is if it was the best idea. And if your idea was the best idea, you couldn't just say, hey, my idea is the best idea, and shout at everybody until they stopped talking. You actually had to have people adopt and use your idea. So that when they would have competing ideas, they would wait until the market and the players would just sort of converge on one of the ideas, and then they would say, that's the one. And by naming it RFCs, and here's something from September 1981, it's still named an RFC, even though it's like over 30 years old, because there's this notion that there could always be something better, right? It's this open-ended notion that this is just a reasonable enough idea. It's not perfect. It didn't come from heaven. It's just engineers doing the best they can, and there might be an improvement that anybody might bring to it. So it's a very open-ended way of thinking about it. So another sort of pattern for the picture, so we have this layered architecture, and then here's another pattern. The pattern is, this is sort of a physical pattern where we have a host that goes across a link to a router to another router. Usually there's, you know, more of these like 15, and finally it makes it to the destination host. So it's like Michigan, and this is like Stanford, right? And so there's a lot of hops in between. Now if we layer the four-layer architecture on top of this, this is one host. And so that could be your laptop, and this could be the web server sitting at Stanford. And inside your laptop, there are sort of four kinds of pieces of software. The application layer, the transport layer, the internet layer, and the link layer are all sitting in all your laptops and all the servers. And so if I start with this sort of physical thing that says it leaves the host and hops, it's sort of within your computer, it kind of works its way down through the stack, out the network connection, then it sort of bounces across the country, and then it kind of pops out in that server, works its way up the stack inside the server out to the application. So the applications are talking to one another. So as I go through this picture, you just got to be able to sort of overlay the fact that this is a computer, this is a computer, and this part in the middle is the cloudy internet bit, right? So the distance between here and here is infinitesimally small because it's inside the RAM of your computer. And the distance between here and here could be thousands of miles. So it's not drawn to scale at all because this is just pieces of software inside one computer. This is a router. Each one of these things is a router. So that's a physical piece of hardware. But the distance between this might be 1,000 miles easily. So not drawn to scale. Oops. Okay. So the thing that this architecture allows us to do is narrow down our focus, right? Narrow down our focus significantly. And but I wish I had an Ethernet wire.
buggers, they got it plugged in. They got it like, so I can't break it. Ha! Oh, crap, I'd have to cut it. Uh-oh, now I've screwed it up totally. Damn it. Well, I'll pretend. Oh, no, here it is. It's black. That's why I couldn't see it. It was hiding in plain sight. Okay. I need this prop. Okay. So we focus down. And if you remember, Vint talked about the fact that there would be satellites, there would be phone wires, there would be wireless. And the link layer is the way to really focus on that. So two examples of the link that's working inside this room is this piece of wire right here called Ethernet, which is very common local area networking, very high speed, and the Wi-Fi are two link layers. Now, these link layers are just usually one piece of media. Like Wi-Fi, it goes maybe 300 feet at the most. This piece of wire, well, however long you can drag it, right? And if you don't have a backhoe, you can only like drag it some part of this building and then we're done. So these things have limited geographic length. And so with this layered architecture, people can focus on that and ignore the rest of the world. And so this wire here, this Ethernet wire right here, it's been around for over 30 years, the concept of Ethernet. And originally when this concept came out, it was 10 million bits a second. And then it, after like 10 years, it was 100 million bits a second. And now it's a billion bits per second that goes through this wire. And am I like, well, okay, everything gets faster and cheaper. But the amount of engineering that's gone into this piece of wire sitting here is probably 150,000 engineers have touched, electrical engineers, computer people have touched the definition of this wire. And if you feel it, you feel it has a certain twist to it. I'm telling you, hundreds of electrical engineers have spent thousands of hours figuring out exactly how to twist the wires in this. Because this Ethernet is so fast, when it's going at full speed, if the curve in this wire is like that, it works. If the curve in the wire is like that, it doesn't work. That's how much engineering. I mean, it took a long time to make it a billion bits a second to go through this wire. The problem is a billion bits a second, you end up with magnetic fields that collapse on each other, and you can't move a billion bits because it starts clogging up because the magnetic field that kind of pops up and down around this thing collapses on itself. So when you build buildings, you have to make these wires go in these right gentle curves. It's almost like it flies off the end. That's not exactly what it's doing. It's just, it becomes like a resistor. It resists the current if it's turned like this. The other thing is, like some engineer, probably hundreds of engineers, figured out how you would not lose data when I put it next to this monitor and there's radiation coming from the monitor. Or it's near a light bulb. How to make this thing work when it's near a light bulb? How do you make it so it doesn't screw your computer up when you put it? So this has to do with the focus, right? This is where there's hundreds of thousands of engineers made this piece of wire. Now, we don't really care. Now, a different 100,000 engineers made your Wi-Fi work, right? Now, I know more about Wi-Fi because I've been to one of the Wi-Fi meetings. This is probably 10 years ago that I went to one. There's like 800 people show up in a hotel, 800 people from all these companies show up in a hotel, and they argue about the next thing about Wi-Fi. Then they go back to their labs and they implement what they thought. Then they come back and go out and come back and come out. And then they come up with like 803G and then 803N. But that takes like 1,000 people to show up 4 times a year to make that kind of progress. And not only are they working 1 week a year, but they're going back to their labs and building new hardware and equipment. But that's like 10 years of effort, maybe even 20 by now, of making your Wi-Fi work. So this layered architecture, when they build Wi-Fi, they don't care about Stanford, they don't care about fiber optic, they don't care about anything. And so there's this beautiful focus that comes from this layered architecture. So common link layers, Ethernet, Wi-Fi, cable modem is another example of a DSL, satellite, fiber optic. These are all sort of one physical media that kind of gets a certain distance. Now, many of these media are shared. So the Wi-Fi that's in this room is pretty much shared by all your computers. And so You don't seem to think that it's shared. You think that Wi-Fi belongs to you exclusively. You hit refresh on Facebook and your Facebook page comes up. And it's not like everyone else's computer crashes when you hit refresh. You're still only sharing one Wi-Fi in this room. So there's got to be a way of sharing this. And so the way Wi-Fi and Ethernet are shared is what's called a MAC address, Media Access Control. And each of the computers, both your Wi-Fi and if you have an Ethernet connector on your computer, they have a serial number built in. And you can go, I know how to do it on a Mac, you sort of work your way down through preferences and system settings, and you find this Ethernet ID. And you will not find two Macintoshes with the same ID. They're, when they make these at the factory, they imprint an ID, a serial number on them. Now the first bit is a prefix, and so that, you know, all the Apples might have the first numbers the same, but then the second are actually a manufacturing number. And so every Wi-Fi and every Ethernet has one of these numbers on it. And so if you think about what's going on inside this room, if this was Wi-Fi instead of Ethernet, this is your computer, and it's got a serial number, and inside a closet there is another computer that's going to connect you to the internet, and it's got a serial number as well. So all the computers in the room have a different serial number, including the router that moves the data beyond here. And so the way your computers seem to be working as if you're the only one in the room is because your computer is selectively only listening to the data that comes to the serial number that is yours. The router inside the closet has a list of all of you. And so it can send a packet out, mark it with the serial number, and all the rest of the computers are voluntarily ignoring that packet and only taking the ones. Now, if you're a bad person, you can actually tweak your Wi-Fi, and I'm sure there's plenty of downloadable software that does this, to actually watch all the traffic. Right? So it doesn't just, you're voluntarily not looking at everybody else's traffic. That's why it seems like everyone's exclusive. Okay? And then, of course, there's packets, and you're not simultaneously using it. They still have to share. A packet comes, but your computer is technically hearing all the packets and throwing away the ones that don't belong to it. So what about when your computer wants to send some data? Well, there have been a lot of very complex logic about this, but it turns out, you can't exactly at the same moment, two computers cannot be talking. So they have to have exclusive access to the Wi-Fi for a 100,000th of a second, but for that moment, you've got to have exclusive access. So the technique that's used in lots of shared media is the following. You listen, and if it's quiet, you start sending data. And then you listen again, and if you hear your own data coming back, you think that no one has stepped on you. If two people start talking at the same time, you go, no. So that when two computers start talking at the same time, they have to do the same thing. And they know that because they started talking, but they didn't hear exactly what they said. Now, humans are particularly bad about stopping, right? We all have exactly the same clock in our head as when we step on each other. We just come back exactly 3/4 of a second later or whatever it is, and we just can't seem to get the conversation started. Now, computers, they would have the same problem if they all said, well, I had a problem, I'll wait 1/100 of a second and do it again. Then it'd be like, So there's actually, it's a real complex thing to make it random, but yet fair. So that usually, if your two computers crash, they stop and they wait a different amount, and it turns out to be fair. But it's a real simple concept, and it allows the sharing in time of a very fast connection, but a connection that each of your computers has to use exclusively for the moment that it's using it. Okay, that's the link layer. That kind of gets you 40 feet or a couple hundred miles if it's fiber optic. So as Vince said, the thing that they had to build was a way to move data from one network, i.e. a Wi-Fi network, then we're going to have a fiber optic network on the campus, then maybe a phone network and a satellite network. How can we come up with an address that understands the concept that there are groups of computers connected possibly with different technology locally, but let's give them a global address so that every computer has an address. Now, your computers all have serial numbers.
And you think, well, that could work, but it can't. Because there's like, what, 20 billion computers? And if your computer had to keep track of where every other computer was individually, that would not be tractable. Because you'd have to know where all 20 billion other computers are at any given moment. The network would have to know this as well. So what they did in this IP layer is they came up with a way to group computers together to simplify the long distance routing. So the internet layer, so the link layer just gets us from one across one piece of media to the next hop. The internet layer is kind of like the postcard layer. That's the thing that hopes that eventually, even if it gets lost or rerouted or misdirected, we know eventually where the thing is going. It's going to Stanford. Who knows, it might go to Houston, it might go to Kansas City, who knows where, but eventually it's got to go to Stanford. So how do we know where all the Stanford computers are without having to keep track of every computer on Stanford's campus? Now, what's also cool about this is that it's unreliable. It's supposed to be as reliable as it can be, but it's designed to allow its best effort, and it's okay to drop packets if things fail or you run or a network link goes down. You just throw the data away. You don't freak out about it. So they invented, as Vince said, these IP, Internet Protocol addresses. This is a worldwide number, except unlike the serial number, which depends on when it was manufactured and who manufactured it, this depends on where you're physically connected. And this encodes in it some sense of geographic locality. Now, it's not like there's US and Michigan. It's just there's a group of computers on the U of M campus, and they can all be identified with what's called a prefix. So the world seems to know where you're from. So if you go online and you type IP address lookup, so this is my IP address. It's four dotted numbers, 67194. See, I'm remodeling my office at home, and so it seems to know that I want a table. I haven't bought the table yet. I'm going to eventually buy this one. And they know that, apparently. I want an electric lift one so I don't have to sit down all the time, but they're $1,000 because they go up and down. It's the latest and coolest thing. All my friends in California are doing it. So, what's this now? Oh, great. It doesn't know everything about me, apparently. Let's see, what else? VPN. Yeah, I guess I could use some hosting. Okay, so this has a sense of where I'm at, right? It says I'm somewhere in Ann Arbor. Now, it's not going to know very well. It kind of knows we're grouped together in a big blob from Michigan, University of Michigan. That could be a lot of places. So it's not precise to the, it's not like a GPS. It's like the world sees your network as having to dump the data into Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, and then we'll let Michigan figure that out. Okay, and so you'll, hopefully all you will see sort of the roughly the same thing, and maybe you will all want to date 50-year-old singles. Or maybe you'll get a different ad. You'll hopefully get a different ad that doesn't include a electronic table and 50-year-old singles. Okay. So these numbers, these IP addresses, are dotted, four dotted numbers. Each of the numbers is from 0 through 256, 141.211.144.188. Now the amazing thing that they did was all they did was they said, we're going to split these numbers into two parts. We're going to call this the network number. That's kind of an agglomeration of computers. And so anything that starts with 141.211 **, that's going to drop into the Michigan campus. Then we can use these numbers. We'll let Michigan assign these separately. Vint mentioned John Postel, who took care of the numbers. He would give you a chunk, and then you would manage them on your campus. So John Postel, you say, hey, we're connecting Michigan. And John would say, I'll give you 141.211. Now, this is not United States, this is not whatever. They were actually, other than that, they're just random, they're a prefix. They're like an area code, right? Zip codes have kind of a geographic notion to them. The lower ones are the East Coast, the higher ones are the West Coast. Area codes are not like that. They're just kind of, 734 is kind of a not counting cell phones, who have ruined everything. But 734 is kind of a geographic notion. 141 to 11 is a group of folks, but like, it's not that 735 is particularly close to 734. It's not. So this is a geographic grouping, but it's not sort of, the number assignment is not geographic. And the same is true here. It's a grouping, and all the people with this prefix are geographically close, but 142.211 is not particularly close. If any of these changes, it's like an area code changing, it's a completely different place, but it is still represents a group. So this is the way the internet outside of campus thinks of Michigan in this oversimplified way and does not track the serial numbers of all of our computers. So we go from, let's just say, 100,000 computers on this campus to one number that captures the notion of all these computers on campus. So that's what Vint was saying. I want to send to a computer on a network. This is the network, and that's the computer on the network. So we break this address into two halves. Which network are we going to? Which computer are we going to within that network? And the internet, the core backbone of the internet, only thinks in terms of network numbers. So if I'm going to send a packet to Stanford from Michigan, which is my 141.211, it winds its way somehow through the Michigan network understands all four numbers. But as soon as it leaves the Michigan campus, the internet itself stops looking at the other two numbers and says, 67149, that's Stanford. Literally, we could have 50,000 computers running, but all the packets would look, they'd only look at the prefix. And it has to find the way to Stanford. And it starts picking links and forwarding. Then when it dumps it onto Stanford's campus, then Stanford starts looking farther into the address and gets it to the right system at Stanford. Any questions? So this network number reduces the complexity of what the routers and the internet have to understand by letting our campus deal with the fine detail of routing within our campus and then grouping your accounts together. So no single router knows the entire network. It's like a simple post office in Kansas City. It has a bunch of stuff coming in and it has two trucks going out, one to Albuquerque and one to Denver. And all we got to do is decide which is the best. And frankly, it wouldn't matter. We could even be wrong, and it would still eventually get there, because the people in Albuquerque would get it there, and the people in Denver would get it there too. Now, the question that the router might want to know is, which of those two is the best? The horizontal one, this one here, is probably best because it's one hop away, and this one is two hops away. But it might be that there's more traffic on this one, so it's kind of clogged all up. And so you have to wait too long, so you might want to send it that one. So routers think about that. But they don't have to think about the whole network. There's literally hundreds of thousands of routers, but they only know a little bit of information. They only have this partial sense of what's going on. And they can even be misinformed at times, and it's okay. So the router tables are the tables of the network destinations that it knows about. And it doesn't really need to know how to get to these, it just needs to know which of those two links it's supposed to send a particular prefix to. They talk to each other, they send each other information. If they see a network they've never seen before, they have to ask around to say, wait a second, how does this one go? I mean, they have a pretty good, the ones in the middle of the network have a pretty good sense of where most of the network numbers go, because there's millions of them, but that's not so bad. Billions is tough, millions is not so bad. So it turns out that it really greatly simplifies this. The internet ends up, the core of the internet is rather simple, and it can be very, very fast as a result, because it doesn't have to be perfect, and etc. So, so I just got done telling you that these IP addresses are geographic. What happens with a laptop? How does a laptop work, right? You could drive to home, and your home is geographically, from the network's perspective, different than this room, than Starbucks. You cross the street to Starbucks, it's a completely different network. So your computer cannot have the same address at Starbucks as here, because this data for your computer here has to come here. At Starbucks, it has to be routed there. So there's a thing called the Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, or DHCP. And you may have seen this in some kind of configuration screens on your home router or whatever. What this is basically handing out IP addresses to dynamic devices that show up. So when you open your laptop, it finds a wireless network that it can talk to, and then once it associates with the wireless network, like M Wireless, the first thing it says is, hey, M Wireless, I would like an IP address that works for this room. M Wireless goes, oh, you can use 141.26.14.7 for this room. It actually ends up with this table of the 141.26.14.7 mapped to the serial number of your computer. So it's got a table inside there giving each of you an address and remembering what your serial number is. So that it is basically giving you a global address. And as a matter of fact, so I can look up on my little gadget that can look up. That is the address that I happen to be using right now. And that was the one that you saw. And actually, if I spent enough time, you could connect and send data to the back of my computer. Now, it turns out some local area networks will block it, but this one doesn't. Right? I could put a web server on that computer, and you from anywhere in the world could talk to the web server running on that computer because that address is a global address. Okay? So, but if I move, I get a different address. In my office, I'll get a different address. At Starbucks, I'll get a different address.
So, Chuck, one question then.
Yeah.
We get as many IP addresses as many connections we make.
No. You have one IP address until you close your laptop and leave and open your laptop somewhere else. Then you get a different one.
Okay.
But while you're talking to Facebook, and if you're talking to Facebook and Google and Yahoo and Amazon, your address doesn't change while you're sitting there.
Yeah, but imagine that, I change now. I'm using now wireless.
Yep.
But then imagine that I switch off the wireless option and I use an internet.
Then you would get a different one.
Yeah.
It would give you a different one. If you plugged in here,
exactly.
Like let me just plug it in.
So for
I think I just broke this.
We get a different IP address.
This is might be what I broke. Oh, no. Okay. No, I didn't broke it. I broke something else apparently down here. they'll figure out later. So you'll see, I just plugged the wire in, right? And my address changed, right? So as soon as I plugged the wire in, it decided I'll use the wire. So it says, yo, what can I use on this wire? And so it gave me one of these 141 addresses. Now I unplug the wire and be like, oh, crap, that wire's gone. Let's get another address. Oh, there's an address. Thank you very much. It happens in like a zillionth of a second. Yeah.
Does that mean that anybody can trace as to where exactly you were and what you visited and what happened to your computer?
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you're not like an international arms dealer or anything hiding in this room because they're coming to find you right now. Yeah. So you do something in a dorm room and you do something illegal, they'll be knocking on your door pretty fast. And even in this room, right? They know what time it was. They know where you went. You're not really all that private. Thankfully, you're a totally boring individual and no one cares about you. That's what your safety is. Stay boring, right? Stay boring and you'll be okay. Yeah.
While you have that open,
It's
showing the version 6 as well as the version 4.
I'm not going to talk about that.
Vaguely aware of running.
Yeah, I'm talking about version 4 now.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll stay away from version 6.
How long do you think it's going to last, though, before you run out of numbers?
It's already kind of run out of numbers.
Okay.
But we haven't yet crashed yet, so okay. That's deeper than I want to go.
Sure,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh, there's wonderful ways around it. And this happens on my blog all the time. When I have some of my friends that want to post on my blog are a little too smart for this, and they understand all this stuff. So if they want to post anonymously to my blog, they know that I would look up their address. Right? So it turns out, and we'll get to this sort of in security, it turns out that one of the most common things to do with viruses, and then one of the most common reasons that they give you viruses is to turn your computer into a zombie reflector. And so you got a computer sitting at home right now, and if you got a virus, chances are good that it is waiting to launder somebody's incoming IP address. They bounce traffic through your house so that when they do something illegal, it goes back to your house. They can trace it to your house, but given that where it came from on the way into your house is lost, and it turns out that you can
rent people's zombie computers. There are criminals that just like infect your computer, control your computer, and sell access through your home computer to bad guys who want to cover their trails. There's also computers like in Finland that do this as well. So there's all kinds of ways to bounce your stuff through stuff. The danger is, who knows if that thing you're bouncing through is not really just an FBI computer, right? Or even those Finland guys are an FBI computer. Or they're watching all the traffic on the way through Finland, on the way out. I mean, so you just, if you're an international arms dealer, it's tough, right? I mean, there are ways to keep it so that I can't figure out how you blog posted anonymously. I'm not that good, but it's hard to hide. Any questions? Are there any questions? Okay. Where are we? Okay. So, these addresses that we have in our computers are actually here at the University of Michigan. Both addresses that I've got, the 67 address and the 141 address, are actual real live globally routable addresses. But if you go home, you'll find at your house it's probably 192.168.0.something. And if you go to your neighbor's house, it's 192.168.0.something. You go to another neighbor's house, it's 192.168.0.something. If you go to Starbucks, it's 192.168.0.something. That seems to violate what I just said, right? That every time you move, you get a new prefix so that you can route. And the way that happens is they knew that there would be little sort of like padded cell environments that they didn't want to give real addresses to every computer in the room. It's a decision Michigan made when configuring this room to give you real addresses. They could have given you fake addresses, what are called non-routable addresses. And the way these work is, if the core network ever sees them, it throws them away. They're supposed to only work on a local area network. And so the way it works at Starbucks is, here's a picture. So if you go to Starbucks in the top line, they've got some real address at the top, 141.206, and then your computer asks for an address and it gives you one of these local addresses, and then it maps from your local temporary address to the real one. So the data that goes across the network actually comes from that address, not the one that's on your computer. And so it's called network address translation, where the data going out comes from an address used locally on this network but not routable globally, but it gets changed to a global address. So then you leave and you go from Starbucks to this room. Well, not this room, that's a bad example. McDonald's. McDonald's has an address also in that for that particular McDonald's, but then it gives you another one of these. And the fact that these are like identical, should be on the same network, doesn't matter, because they're only useful for that sort of one Wi-Fi connection. And as it leaves the building at McDonald's, it gets a real address. And then the same is true if you go to your neighbor's house. They give you a local number. It could even be the same number as that one, but it's not the same, because when you're going through this gateway, it's adding whatever the real global thing is. So you kind of get them kind of attached on in the closet. The closet gives you the nice thing about that is they can't get back to you because your computer really isn't officially on the internet with a fully routable address. So there's the two prefixes. 192.168 are one that's used for all the sort of local stuff that's only within the next 50 feet or so. And there's one that if it's 10 dot, the 10 prefix is also used for these local addresses. So it is now time to read the XKCD again. So we're trying to scare the children around the campfire, and instead of telling the classic story of there was a hook in the car door when he drove away, say that their killer was a 192.168 prefix block, which means that it probably was in within 300 feet. Right, so that's just how scary it is. So the bad guy's computer is within 300 feet. That's why that's so scary. If, for example, that was a 141 prefix, you would know, they're far away. I'm safe. But if that's a 192 address, that's bad. Okay. Okay, so we have this address that is kind of like a
phone number that's broken into two pieces. And it takes multiple hops to get across the network. These routers sort of bounce things around. And these routers are imperfect. So they don't have perfect information. So one of the problems that we need to solve is the fact that a set of routers could be configured in a way that send a packet in a circle because their information is imperfect. This would be like a postcard that goes to Kansas City, to Denver, to Albuquerque, back to Kansas City, to Denver, to Albuquerque, around and around and around. All, and you kept sending postcards, the trucks would fill up, right? Because they would never lose it. So if you did this, it would actually sort of melt the network because the packets would get caught in kind of this vortex. New packets would come in, but nothing would ever come out, and it would just go until the network failed. So this is one of the many things that they had to figure out and had to solve. And so they added a field to every packet, not just the from address and the to address and the kind of the serial number of the packet. They also added this thing called the time to live. And what they do is every time a packet goes through the router, they subtract one from this. And then so the packet starts with a number maybe like 256 or 100 or something. And it goes down from 100, 99, 98, 97, 96. And if it's gone around enough times to the point where that hits zero, the router throws your packet away. And this is the way that packets don't kind of just live on the subway system forever and ever and ever. So they have to get out at some point. Now what they did, again, this is kind of like the early nerd engineers, they decided that it would be a nice thing if a router far, far away finally threw your packet away, that it would send you a note back. Said, you know what? I really am sorry. I had your packet, its number went down to zero, and I threw it away. And I'm so sorry about that, but I thought you'd like to know about that. Okay? And so, we have this command called traceroute. Now, it used to be on Macs and PCs. You can actually go figure out how to like install traceroute on Windows, and they'll do it. There's probably even a traceroute application on Windows, but it doesn't come with it. In XP, it used to come with it. But on Macs, we have it. It's called traceroute. PCs, you have to install something. And what traceroute does is traceroute attempts to divine the structure of the network by sending a series of intentionally flawed packets out. It first sends a packet with a time to live of 1. That goes across one hop, and the router throws it away and gives you a courtesy note back. Then you send one out with 2. Goes across 2 hops. Courtesy note comes back. And slowly but surely, then you time them, and then you figure out, oh, here's the path. So let me show you how that works. So it's now that's 10 hops. It's starting to slow down. Sometimes the data gets lost, actually. See that asterisk? That was a lost packet. The milliseconds are thousandths of a second, so 93 milliseconds is about a tenth of a second. So we started, we started at Michigan. We did SEB, wherever that's at. That's probably something on campus. Something else cool on campus. Arbor Lakes on campus, right? Let me point to these, right? So it's on our campus, Arbor Lakes, somewhere in Arbor Lakes. Now it's going to through Wayne State. Now it's going to probably Washington, D.C., and then it's going to Atlanta, and then it's going to Houston, then it's going to Los Angeles, and then it's sort of bouncing around in California, and looks like it got 2 bounces inside California, then it finally makes it on the Stanford network, and it has a couple of hops on site in Stanford, and it finally makes it to the web server somewhere in a building on Stanford's network. So the asterisks, these are times. It's trying to time how long it takes to get back. Sometimes a packet gets lost. This asterisk here is a packet lost. These asterisks are scumbags. So there are routers that choose not to send you the little courtesy note back, right? And that just means they're there because they threw the packet away, but they didn't identify themselves. So whatever, these are 2 routers on the Stanford campus that have been configured not to answer. Yeah. I think it's a combination of security as well as performance, right? They don't want to. There are things that wander around and do traceroute all the time to sort of have the world's most glorious map.
Wouldn't that just pretty much tell the whole world what the front door is of the Stanford network and just
Yeah, but it's not that you can't get into the Stanford network. It's really the internal structure. I'm sure they think of it from, I'm sure there is a reason to know in case like this router has a security hole in it, perhaps, that you could go right to it. So I'm sure there's a security justification, but it's usually more of a performance justification. And it's like, I'm going to let you go. I'm not letting you do this within Stanford. I don't want you to sort of map the Stanford campus. I think it's as much just to discourage spiders that really kind of spider this information from going all the way through your thing and trying to keep what the Stanford map looks like. So that's Stanford, and it takes 17 hops to get to Stanford. Now the interesting thing, if we go all the way back to BitNet and stored forward networking, it still took 17 or 20. The difference is it's like a hundredth of a second, or a tenth of a second, or a hundredth of a second now. It used to be like days and sitting on disk drives on the way across. And so that's the essential difference between packets. It's not that it doesn't take multiple hops. It's just the hops are quick. And the pieces that we send are tiny. So that's Stanford. This is a picture from some time ago when I did it. It's different. Here's a traceroute to Michigan State. So I mentioned the Merit Network last week. We have really good connectivity within the state of Michigan because we have like a network, statewide network. And you saw the packet to Stanford go through Wayne State. And sometimes the packets from Michigan go to Michigan State to Chicago, and sometimes they went to Wayne State to Washington. Depends on where we get the best deal, and we're changing this stuff all the time. I mean, every 6 months or so. So, but it's only 8 hops to get to Michigan State's web server. But you can also see more interesting stuff. So this is Peking University in China. And so in this particular thing, it takes 12 hops to get to Peking University. But you can take a look as it's going. It takes 3 hops to get off campus in this particular thing. And then it goes from Michigan to Tennessee. Looks like it's going across the country. And then all of a sudden, the numbers get a lot bigger. This is 2/10 of a second. This is almost 3/10 of a second. And the reason they get bigger is it's going under the Pacific Ocean. And it's slowing down. Speed of light takes a while to get across the Pacific Ocean. So light seems pretty fast, but it takes time. The fact that these are so consistent suggests it's not traffic related. If these were going up and down under high traffic, you'd get inconsistency. But the fact that they're so close suggests that it's just the speed of light that's going on. So from here to Beijing is 2/4 of a second. And this was obviously done. Let's see what it is right now. Yeah. So it's a Houston. Let me get one of them scumbags that won't tell us who they are or where they are. And it might even be true once we hit the Pacific thing that they're not going to give us any data because they don't want us wasting their... Oh, okay. There we go. 1/3 of a second now. So the fact that these numbers are going up and down, the timing is sending 3 of them, right? So these numbers are going up and down suggests that maybe this is kind of a heavily loaded link, maybe, right? I don't know. But you can see why some routers don't want to talk about this. People would write software that would just like dig this information out all the time, make cool maps of the whole network. So it's still sort of talking to some routers that are not very happy. So hey, let me show you something else. I can trace route an address that doesn't even exist. 111.111.111. Who knows if this computer even exists? Because Michigan's network and all the network in between here and there have no idea if this computer actually exists or not. It's like a zip code or an area code. I'm going to get you close. So let's see where it might have been. We can see kind of the city that it ends up in, but we're not necessarily going to find a computer by the time it's all said and done. Okay, now I think it's getting a little lost.
But it found its way to Japan, right? If that computer had a number, it'd probably be in it. If there was a computer with that number, it'd be like have to be there, right? So it's finding its way, right? But that tells you the internet doesn't really know if that computer exists or not. It's just like, I'm hopeful. I'll try. Okay? So it didn't need to exist. Let's try another one. Where's that at? It's not telling us much, is it? See, it gets to a point where it's just gone off into the deep end because there's nowhere else to go. But we don't know where those things are at. That wasn't very fun. Try a different one. No, it's got to be up to 256. These are all up to 0 to 256. Ooh, where's that? I don't know what this means. Maybe that means I'm mad at you. Stop doing that. I hate you. So whatever. Okay. So we'll stop doing this before people like come kicking the windows in, you know, with their helicopters and say, "What are you doing?" That turns out to be the FBI's number. Why are you talking to the FBI's computer? How'd you know that? How'd you figure that number out? It's like, no, I'm just teaching a class. Okay. So I just sort of sent packets to things that don't exist, and the network yet did its best, and then finally threw it away, or sent it in a circle, or did whatever, right? It's not perfect. It's not like phone system, right? You don't get a busy signal. It either works awesomely, or it just fails. This turns out to be critical in the design of the whole thing to release the constraint of perfection. By making IP imperfect, it can be gigantic. It can be screaming fast when everything's working, and then just falls apart when it doesn't work. So, the perfect is the enemy of the good. So, let's take a break for 10 minutes.